Recently, amendments to the World Health Organization International Health Regulations were hastily passed behind closed doors in a late-night blitz at the World Health Assembly in Geneva. Fortunately, several of the most egregious sections of earlier drafts had been removed. However, this rushed approval process provided a big lesson on what we can expect to come from the World Health Organization and how proposals of the same ilk could be arbitrarily pushed through in the future. And at the same time, we have Dr. Anthony Fauci's recent testimony, where he distanced himself from a key advisor and denied receiving any of the $710 million in COVID royalties that the NIH was paid by pharmaceutical companies from 2021 to 2023. Join us for this week's episode of Fallout with a special guest, Frank Gaffney, co-founder of the Sovereignty Coalition.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Fallout with Dr. Robert Malone and myself, Yanya Kellick, senior editor at the Epoch Times. Today, we've got a very special guest. We've got Frank Gaffney. Frank is the co-founder of the Sovereignty Coalition, and they are both recently fresh off a plane from Geneva, having been there as the international health regulations were passed. Frank, it's great to have you. Robert, always a pleasure. So what happened in Geneva?
What happened in Geneva was that there was a meeting of something called the World Health Assembly, which is the equivalent for the World Health Organization of the UN's General Assembly. That is to say, all of the member nations are gathered. It's usually a once a year event. And this year, they were supposed to do not one, but two things, two different accords. I believe they both should be considered treaties, because they're international, legally binding documents. One that was intended to give vast new powers to the Director General of the World Health Organization in the event of pandemics, or more broadly, actual or potential public health emergencies of international concern. And he could then advise nations as to what they better do about it. That treaty foundered for lots of different reasons.
There was an official promoted narrative about why it failed. Essentially, that the emerging economy nations wished to have better access to products and technology. And this is the official line, the developed nations and their pharmaceutical giants were not interested in technology transfer and enabling the emerging economies to be able to produce their own medicines, I think is the kind of the punchline.
Yeah, I think that's basically right. I mean, it was parochial interests at the core. That was shelved for the time being, probably not for very long, in favor of trying to get something done, anything done, on this other treaty, which would amend the existing international health regulations of the World Health Organization.
Which have been in place since 2005, right?
Well, they've been amended, I think, once after that, 2022, in a relatively modest way, but 2005 was the bigger one. But the problem here was we watched the evolution of this from everything that was initially desired by the negotiators into something that I compare it to kind of a balloonist trying to get over a high peak, and they had to keep throwing things off the balloon in order to clear the mountain. Mm-hmm. And in this case, some of the really problematic stuff did go over the side, but the process was very problematic, and we were there to be witnesses to it.
What was actually won? Because from what I've heard, I mean, we've discussed this. There's a number of things, from what I understand, that were actually stricken.
As we're flying back from Geneva to land in Dulles, both Frank and I are busy poring through the PDF that documents what exactly was agreed upon, or if you call that an agreement. And what strikes me in reading the document is absolutely that there's this unilateral power, amazing level of power in terms of global public health. It's vested exclusively with the Director General. But what also strikes me is a lot of the terms and conditions, which are largely inherited from the prior document, which was mostly written as an advisory. Mm-hmm. So you can kind of imagine the WHO as a quasi-diplomatic organization serving as a somewhat of a neutral broker between nation states. But then this new language came in with the earlier drafts that was very prescriptive, that was saying, you will do this, you shall build this kind of infrastructure, you shall take these actions, you shall vaccinate or provide medical treatments if the WHO says you should. We had this language come out in the early drafts that could be traced back to our administration that was, you know, frankly authoritarian and very prescriptive and very much aligned with what a lot of the practices have been that we've observed during the COVID crisis, mm-hmm. including mandates and all these other things, lockdowns, things that have traditionally not been considered best practices in public health, as our colleagues Jay Bhattacharya and others would teach based on what the history and epidemiology and public health practice has been. So this language came out, and there was 9 or 10 key points that your group identified and others concurred with that were particularly egregious. That language was largely replaced with language that was more like what had been in the past, the more
hortatory.
Yes.
Advisory.
So, yeah, advisory.
Collaborative.
Yeah, a lot of collaborative. Remember, we said earlier on that there was this tension between the developed world and the emerging world. So this document now has a lot of language in it that we might say is very pro-technology transfer, infrastructure development, around
redistribution of wealth.
Is another way to put it. Yeah, it's written around the logic that it is the responsibility of all member states to collectively work together to advance equity and inclusion and to enable the development of infrastructure and capacity and the transfer of technology into these developing nation states so that they can produce their own medicines, basically.
Yeah. So it's agreement in principle.
Yeah.
They kicked the thing down the road, but again, not very far. But to your larger point, what they've done in setting the stage with what's left in the balloon is the precursor to any number of subsequent changes, which using the precedent that they've just established most recently this weekend, is going to enable them at will to return to some of those really egregious and worrying things.
Just to provide a bit of context, you have many hats, Frank, but one of them is your leadership and co-founding role in this group called the Sovereignty Coalition that I've been watching and have been kind of at the periphery of for quite a while now.
We think of you as a member.
Okay, well, that's kind. A member in absentia a lot of times. But you and your group, I think, have been providing consistent leadership and analysis, detailed analysis of this process now for over a year. This very opaque process. They really have not been transparent about what they have been doing, what the plans have been, what the text has been. It seems like at every turn they've tried to hide things.
Well, they have. Actually, it's not just that it seems this way, it's the design. At the end of the day, the proponents of these things have made it absolutely clear that what they seek to do is to advance a long-term agenda they call global governance. And the truth of the matter is the American people, and I think others around the world, are not going to go for creating some new elite entity or entities that would tell them what to do rather than, in our case, limited, accountable, representative and constitutional government. So you had to do this by stealth. As you think about what has just played out, and the bottom line of what we witnessed in Geneva was in the dark of night, and I mean
literally
in the dark of night, about 9 p.m. on a Saturday, they blew through.
The last day of their conference.
Last minutes of the conference without any opportunity to actually go through, let alone have a proper public review or debate, what they were agreeing to. And the agreement was done, we're told, with only about a third of the members in the room. Some have actually reported that the microphones were turned off when it was announced that a consensus had been arrived at and the agreement was now approved. This is the kind of thing that I think reinforces most of our concerns about having these guys run anything, let alone anything that might infringe upon our constitutional form
of
government.
Well, this isn't the first time that we've seen this type of decision-making emerge from the World Health Organization. I like to cite the example of how the monkeypox public health emergency event was managed, which was very unilateral and really arbitrary and capricious. Mm-hmm. It provides a great example to illustrate the language that is in what we're talking about now is the international health regulations that were in place going back to at least 2005 that are now being amended in this kind of dead of night, last minute thing. And so the monkeypox outbreak and, of course, COVID have provided great examples of how they actually deploy these steps and action items that are laid out in the document, even as it existed before these amendments, in which they have a panel of expert advisors that are appointed by the Director General. No other oversight. The Director General has the full authority to appoint the panel of experts. And then from that is derived an advisory panel that's convened around any particular issue that the Director General may wish to convene it for. And then there's also a review panel that's assembled to look at the advisory that comes out of this expert panel. And then that information comes to none other than the Director General, who's appointed them all, who can accept their advice or decide to do otherwise. In the case of the monkeypox outbreak, which is fascinating, is the expert panel convened initially to make a determination. He gives them the question to be addressed, and so they address the question of whether or not monkeypox at that time, after the Canary Islands outbreak, represented a public health event of concern and a potential pandemic threat. And the panel decided that it wasn't. At which point, the Director General, Mr. Tedros, decided that he would disband that advisory panel and convene a new one, which was more representative of the population at risk for monkeypox. And so he convened that panel, and they examined the issue, and they had a vote about whether or not they believed that it met the criteria for an emergency event, which Mr. Tedros decided that that was a tie. And so he would just go ahead and break the tie and declare it a pandemic, an emergency event that would then trigger all of the capabilities that are vested in the WHO by this accord, this agreement, this International Health Regulations document. This is again established that this process of apparent consensus, passing key decisions without actually having a vote, where no one is able to be held accountable for that decision, when a true stakeholder or member input is not solicited, it becomes basically decision-making by fiat by the Director General. It's hard to argue that they haven't established a precedent in the latitude to make whatever changes they want unilaterally whenever they feel like, because they clearly don't feel bound by their own article. This is Article 55 that lays out exactly how amendments are to be done, and they've just completely disregarded that and moved ahead and are busy celebrating the... Now, that there are, as they call it, states parties, that's their word for nations, independent nations, that are raising the alarm about this. And one of them has, surprisingly to me, been the United Kingdom, the British government, where there are dissenters and senior people in their judicial system that are making the point that this, quote, agreement now that they have moved forward, this new modification of the IHRs, is illegal, that they have not followed their established procedure. I'm hearing Britain is objecting to this. The United States and France were among the key sponsors of this, so they're all in on it. But there appears to be a subset of more European nations that are objecting to it.
Yeah, but in particular with respect to this set of amendments, they were, by their own regulations, supposed to provide at least 4 months advance notice of what was in these amendments before the World Health Assembly could give them consideration. That was supposed to happen by the end of January. It didn't happen. So our concern is these guys will use whatever authority and rules they choose to abide by to get them accomplished in the future. Let me give you a couple of examples of what we're really concerned about here. There are a couple of infrastructure things, as Robert said, one of which is a requirement. Now, this was in the last one. Now it's slightly modified, but a requirement to have some kind of health IDs. Now it's described as either digital or paper. A digital ID for health purposes becomes a platform for adding all kinds of other information besides your private personal health information.
They do appear to mirror the agenda in terms of identification and information tracking on individuals that has been put forth by the World Economic Forum and the Bank of International Settlements.
Yeah. But what it also gives rise to, if I may, is something that can be the platform for finishing out the China model that Tedros recommended we adopt instead of our pandemic response. But the point is that if you insert into this a digital identification apparatus, you can get the rest of the China model, which is called the social credit system, the most comprehensive totalitarian surveillance and control apparatus ever imagined, not alone in place. And it is operating today in communist China. And they seek, as part of their global governance vision, to make sure that it applies worldwide as part of a scheme. And I want to just say how much I appreciate the Epoch Times and your programming. It's indispensable to explaining just how intent the Chinese are on world domination. And this is a place where you can see it being advanced incrementally, yes, but inexorably towards that grand global governance design. And what we're going to see next, almost certainly, especially at the United Nations, where on the 23rd of September, there is going to be a similar effort to confer upon the UN's top bureaucrat, the Secretary General, the authority to have these extraordinary powers, supranational powers, over non-health emergencies. Asteroids, for example, or black swan events, what have you. And they're going to simply try to run, I think, the same play. The other thing I just wanted to mention that really is another example of the totalitarian intent here, and that is still in the balloon, is a requirement that member nations, these states' parties, will manage, control, preclude, if possible, anything that can be described as mis- or disinformation.
So this is absolutely in Annex 1. They propose the development of basically a new bureaucracy that will serve as the socket between the nation state or the state's parties and the WHO, okay, that is basically the IHR operational group within a nation state, and that will exist at the top level, and then they also propose that it being at the intermediate level. And one of the key tasks that these groups that will be embedded within the state parties or nations, but will be linked basically as the socket back to the WHO, is transmitting information. And under the gathering and transmitting of information are these clauses that they'll also be responsible for building capabilities relating to mis and disinformation.
Yeah. And what does that entail? That entails enforcement via censorship.
We talk now about the censorship industrial complex and the fact that we've created a whole mercenary industry behind this. Mm. And it's not a stretch to say that you're basically defining a business opportunity for those that are staffing and building the capabilities in this censorship industrial complex that will be strongly encouraged to be developed with a 2-year timeline and monitoring to see if you build those capabilities in virtually every nation state that is a participant in the World Health Organization. What a business opportunity.
We have on the wall as our backdrop the founders of our constitutional republic. And I will guarantee you, they are spinning at a high RPM in their graves at the moment at the prospect of what the Biden administration has put in motion here and what has now been agreed in this very bizarre and, I think, frankly, illegal fashion. And unfortunately, the president is quite intent on keeping the United States Senate, which Robert talked about, has expressed its insistence that these one or two of these treaties, whatever comes out, be submitted to them for their advice and consent. And by the way, it is worth mentioning that in addition to the 49 United States senators who've taken that position, there are 22 attorneys general mm-hmm. across the United States and 24 governors mm-hmm. who have also said, in addition to the other constitutional problems here, these agreements, this one in particular, illegally consummated, will infringe upon states' rights as well as national sovereignty and personal, medical, and other freedoms. They don't want any part of it. We shouldn't either.
So this is, and I'm hearing this is a big debate within the legal community, the constitutional scholars in the United States, is there appears there, a case can be made, there's some ambiguity in the Constitution about the primacy of the Constitution relative to treaties. An argument can be made that taking an executive action to endorse this kind of an agreement carries the force in terms of creating the socket with international law as if it is truly a treaty, and that this ambiguity that some claim within the Constitution built around the logic that the executive branch needs to have the latitude to engage in international treaties and shouldn't be constrained by constitutional questions if there is an overriding national interest, allows the ability of such a document to bypass constitutional regulations. And the point you're referring to is that powers vested in the federal government are fairly specific in the Constitution. Those powers that are not vested to the federal government flow to the states. And one of those is the regulation of the practice of medicine. And I was hearing today in the news people talking about the need to, I think it was even in the context of Tony Fauci's testimony this morning, about the need to empower the CDC to have more direct links with the states for gathering and distributing data and providing guidance. This kind of, right now it was stated during the testimony today that this is one of the things that went wrong in the opinion of some members of the House and Dr. Fauci that the CDC really didn't have enough power to insist on gathering information from the states and deploying strategies back into the states. And that's something that has to be fixed. And a cynic might say that this is a backdoor way for the current administration to implement that.
Well, look, just to go back to the censorship for one moment, what they're talking about instituting in the United States in terms of censorship in violation of our First Amendment freedoms is, in fact, what the Biden administration was doing during the pandemic. It was working with the tech companies, and it was going and it was saying people like Robert Malone are disinformers and they should be censured. They should be silenced, but if possible, they should be deprived of employment. And that's the problem here, is this is the starting point. And what we've seen with all of that ballast that's over the side is where they want to take this. We've seen what they do when they have power in the pandemic. We've seen the mechanisms that they've used to accrue more power. This must be stopped. It was illegally done. It will have profound constitutional implications, I believe. And there is also case law before the Senate, the Supreme Court has ruled that you can't use a treaty to infringe upon constitutional rights like freedom of speech. So we'll see how this will sort out. But what we need to do first and foremost is ensure that the Senate of the United States advises and consents on this agreement as the treaty it is. And hopefully, with 49 already saying they're not in favor of this, we'll have ample numbers to exceed the one-third that is required to block such a treaty.
And in some, I hope it's not the case, but the appearance is that this is a stalking horse or a Trojan horse, or another metaphor is the camel's nose that's got itself into the tent, and pretty soon the whole camel is in the tent. And so there's the appearance that that might well be the case. And the fact that this was just deployed in this kind of Saturday night massacre strategy certainly doesn't give me any comfort that Mr. Tedros and the WHO and the World Health Assembly are going to abide by their own regulations.
Behave better in the future.
Yeah, right.
Could I just put in a plug, since you've been kind enough to applaud us? This has been a wonderful team effort. But sovereigntycoalition.org is a place that people can find out more about all of this and also enlist in the fight by signing declarations that we have there and sending them on to their elected representatives.
So Jan, you actually went to the House and sat there during this amazing, or not amazing, testimony by Anthony Fauci today.
I did. And Frank, thank you for giving us the update. I mean, it's amazing that you basically just both got off the plane to do this episode. You look in great shape for that. I have to say thank you. The hearing was, fascinating in the sense I was only there for the first hour and a half or so. I had an interview that I had to rush back to. I have to say, I think that Dr. Anthony Fauci is an absolute master at answering these sorts of questions.
Absolutely.
There seems to be a bipartisan consensus that both Dr. Morenz and Peter Daszak are going to be held accountable for something.
That the fall guys.
That's the main, well, perhaps, but there is going to be some accountability. But it didn't seem like, from that hearing, like it would have to do with Dr. Fauci.
It was very bipartisan. Both sides of the aisle seem to be relatively supportive of Dr. Fauci, thanking him for his public service, his decades of contribution, which was very much in contrast with the prior messaging that we heard with both Daszak and Morenz, in which there was a bipartisan consensus in the other way that they both wanted to feed him to the dogs, it felt like.
One of the things, of course, there's all these emails that Dr. Morenz has talked about in this recent kind of like shocking testimony for those.
That was pretty stunning. The reciting of email after email after email in which he's communicating back with his friend Daszak about these routine meetings that he's having with Tony Fauci.
Dr. Morenz,
your senior advisor for over 20 years, said in an email dated February 24, 2021, "I learned from your FOIA lady here now how to make emails disappear when I am FOIA'd, but before the search starts, so I think we are all safe. Plus, I deleted most of these earlier emails after sending them to Gmail." In another email dated 4/21/21, Dr. Moran said, "I forgot to say, there is no worry about FOIAs. I can either send stuff to Tony," meaning you, "on his private email or hand it to him at work or at his house. He is too smart to let colleagues send him stuff that could cause trouble."
And Dr. Fauci completely denied any association with that, basically made it sound as if Morenz was just fabricating this, that it was his a fantasy in his mind that he had had these repeated conversations with Tony Fauci. Now, the questioner at that time, who is from the Republican side, said, "Well, this is just further evidence of why we need to have more congressional oversight, because clearly you're giving titles to staffers, and then you're telling us that they aren't actually doing the thing that their title implies, that this is a senior advisor mm-hmm. to Tony Fauci, who's had decades of working closely with Dr. Fauci, and Dr. Fauci is positioning himself as if, I hardly know that guy, you know, somewhere works in the building, I'm not sure, it's, you know, that in the context of all the email traffic that then is read aloud to us is not, something isn't consistent.
It calls to mind that old Marx Brothers line about who are you going to believe, me or your lying eyes?
Just so. Yeah. So I agree with you. I've been watching Tony Fauci my entire career, and he conveyed, kind of an avuncular, grandfatherly kind of aura. Kidding around, calling the congressman by their first name. My sense is most of the committee was already with him on this. There seemed to be no appetite for really pressing Dr. Fauci, and he made a series of statements that the vaccine is safe and effective, that it saved millions of lives.
"Vaccines save lives. It is very, very clear that vaccines have saved hundreds of thousands of Americans and millions.
I'm not debating. We're talking about the COVID-19.
Downplayed the adverse events, and repeatedly threw CDC under the bus. Again, there was the questions were asked again and again about the 6-foot distancing, because that was recently in the news, right? Mm-hmm. His admission that this was arbitrary and had no basis in science, mm-hmm. and so he was pressed on what was his science. And were there any data for this? And why didn't he challenge this? And that had been the basis for, a lot of the actions that were taken with school children and their isolating. Remember that some of them were actually in bubbles or they were forced to wear masks. And this was part of the logic for the school closure, was there was no way that we could implement a 6-foot social distancing. And it turns out that this is all completely arbitrary. And when pressed about it, he basically said, oh, it's CDC did that. All in all, it was a kind of a pretty strong defense of policies, except those that were tied back directly to President Trump. And he seemed to find his tongue when speaking about some of those policies. And notably, he did this strategy again where he would link hydroxychloroquine to bleach, this kind of false equivalency.
"When I was saying that if you attack me, you attack science, I didn't mean that I am science. What I meant was that when the data show that hydroxychloroquine does not work, and there are people saying, oh, it does, I'll give it to people, and we know it can be hurtful to them, then when you're attacking what I'm saying, that the science shows it doesn't work, and the science shows that bleach doesn't work, that when you attack that, you really are attacking science, because science has shown that it doesn't work."
And this is strategy that we've seen deployed in the kind of propaganda and psyops around the COVID management decisions all the way through this like this was used early on in the discussions about the lab leak. And there was false equivalency made between some of the observations that suggested that this could have been an engineered pathogen with statements that the virus had HIV sequences in it. Mm-hmm. And that was ridiculed, and by extension, anybody that was suggesting that the virus might have been engineered was also ridiculed. This kind of linkage where you take one extreme and tie it to something that's actually reasonable.
I'll tell you something that just strikes me from our conversation. You know, the whole purpose of this hearing ostensibly was to get Dr. Fauci to talk about COVID origins, but we haven't talked about that yet.
Because he adroitly sidestepped that issue all the way through.
I mean, that's astonishing. I mean, he did talk about, he said there's this definition which was created, and according to that definition,
yeah,
weren't funding
gain of function. Yes, the technical definition of gain of function was trotted out. Mm-hmm. And actually, I'm glad you brought that up, because there was one subtle adjustment in his position compared to what I have heard him say in the past, which was that he's always considered, he's always had an open mind about whether it was a natural origin or a laboratory engineered agent. But of course, the preponderance of evidence in his opinion was that it was of animal origin or natural origin, but that he kept an open mind that that might not be the case. That was actually an opening for him to say that this had been the case, that his belief was that it could be either. So he acknowledged the point that it could have been a laboratory origin. And some of the questioning really put him on the spot, pointing out in the proximal origin paper, for instance, that the authors, he had reviewed that, but he claimed didn't edit it. By the way, that was another thing. He had reviewed that paper before it was submitted, but he didn't edit it. And he tried to kind of create some opening for the authors that they had been fair and objective about the possibility that it might be a laboratory origin. And then he was corrected in real time. He was fact-checked by the questioner that, in fact, they had explicitly concluded that it couldn't possibly have been from a laboratory origin based on their sequence analysis. And there was all kinds of talk around Christian Anderson, in particular, one of the lead authors of that paper, having flip-flopped from a prior position 3 days before, in which he was pretty clear that he thought this had the characteristics of a laboratory origin, to deciding that there's no way it could possibly be a laboratory origin. And when pressed how that could happen in 3 days, Dr. Fauci said, well, he analyzed the sequence, and that could only take a day. And so as soon as he analyzed the sequence, then it was clear to him that, in fact, it was otherwise, that it couldn't possibly be a laboratory origin. They pulled their punches on a number of issues where they could have confronted Dr. Fauci. There was a couple that, notably Marjorie Taylor Greene kind of got a little worked up, probably didn't do herself any favors. And there was a couple of others that made statements that, in addition to MTG, that he should be locked up or subjected to criminal charges. But clearly the committee had no appetite for that. Yeah.
Adam Andrzejewski over at Open the Books, regular guest on American Thought Leaders. And so he figured out that basically NIH has gotten about $700 million in royalties during the pandemic from pandemic-related
items. Like two numbers, one 730.
$690 and $710. Yeah. And let's just call it $700 million.
Yeah. Split the
sizable,
difference.
Sizable
$10
amount,
million here,
right?
$10 million there.
Well, and so the one thing that was incredibly notable, and he was incredibly definitive on this, he said, I got zero of that, right? They said 700 million. So someone else did. I mean, it'll be very interesting to figure out who actually is getting this incredible amount of money in royalties.
Well, and we know his institute was. Mm-hmm. A lot of that money will go directly under the Bayh-Dole Act. A lot of that money will go directly to NIAID. So that'll supplement their budget. Mm-hmm. And it'll come in a form that really isn't subject to congressional oversight. Mm. So it creates these royalty payments, creates something like a slush fund. Just like the Foundation for NIH and the Foundation for CDC are congressionally authorized, basically slush funds that Bill Gates or pharma or anybody else can donate to, that those agencies can use at their discretion.
Well, that's interesting. So are you saying that people in the NIH don't directly benefit?
No. Personally? The actual inventors, mm-hmm. they get a fraction of the royalties, and it's interesting that almost all of the top leadership at the Vaccine Research Center, which is where the Moderna vaccine was engineered, have resigned. They're now private parties. They slipped away. Nobody ever hears of them anymore. And they're collecting probably until they pass away. So there's a cap on that. Mm-hmm. And then typically what happens is that a fraction of the revenue goes to the department or entity that those people were working at. And then the lion's share in academia typically goes to the dean and to the university. And by inference, it must be that the lion's share of those royalties goes to, I would suspect, NIAID writ large in general budget. And the NIH director's office, which people don't realize, they think about Francis Collins as Tony Fauci's boss. That's not really true. The director can't fire these division directors. Mm. They're appointed technically by Congress. Mm. And so the truth is that Tony Fauci has historically only been answerable to Congress, which is why he plays so carefully to Congress when he needs to. He's really outside of even presidential oversight, and certainly outside of oversight by, Francis Collins or whoever the director is. The director of NIH actually has a smaller budget than considerably smaller than the one that Tony Fauci was managing, and very little discretionary capital. So some of that discretionary capital is probably also going to be augmented by this patent royalty. So I suspect that Francis Collins, when he was overall NIH director, was getting organizational benefit through being able to access unencumbered funds that were coming in through these royalties.
So I think we've reached the end of our episode here. And Frank, thank you for being here with us. And everyone, we'll see you next week on Fallout.